Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
On today's podcast, I want to make sure that you are really Clark smart about paying for college education. It is one of the most brutal things that a parent has to decide on is how do you take care of your own financial priorities and your own future, and at the same time not feel that you have shortchanged a teenager when it's time for him or her to go to college. You know, one of the things on the Clark Howard Show, I've gotten so many questions about all through the years, is about saving for college, paying for college, borrowing for college. And something that's very intimidating, I've had to fill it out myself, is the FAFSA, which you fill out each year as a parent for a child in college. I have a college junior, and her college is not exactly a bargain. And so you fill out the FAFSA, which then is used by the colleges to try to figure out what loans, grants, what kind of work you might qualify for, what kind of tuition you're expected to come to the table with. And the FAFSA is something that has gotten easier to fill out, but has been one that has caused so much angst in people and anxiety that it leads you reaching for generic versions of antacids, never brand name. Anyway, with the FAFSA, it gives you something called the EFC. Anybody who's ever figured one out knows about the EFC, which stands for Expected Family Contribution. Well, and one of the weirdest things in the new federal stimulus law that was signed into effect just in the last week of December is it outlaws the EFC. No longer will you have to worry about what it says you're expected to contribute towards your kid's college education, because the number created massive anxiety and led to an unexpected worry on a parent's part or a family's part about what portion of a kid's college they were going to have to pay, and it had no relation to reality. So you still want to fill out the FAFSA. It's still used as a basis. And by the way, you fill out the FAFSA even if you've psyched yourself out that you've decided that your family income is too high and you're going to get no help for college. That's not necessarily true. You fill it out. Now, at my daughter's university, they take the FAFSA, and they issue a three-digit score that then determines what financial aid each student is going to get. And the score goes from 000 to 999. And you don't want a 999 because that means that your student qualifies, your son or daughter qualifies for no financial assistance at all. A 000 means everything for your college is totally a free ride. No academic scholarships, only financial at her school. So every school takes the FAFSA information and processes it differently. And I'm going to take your questions now, but coming up later in this podcast, I want to talk about the burden that families take on, parents take on out of guilt about a son or daughter wanting to go to this school, that school, or the other school, and then how it can destroy your personal financial security as a parent for the rest of your life. But right now, your questions, that was like a TV tease, right? Yes. You know, they say in TV, we're going to tell you how we're going to kill you, and then we're going to tell you how we're going to save you. So, Krista, what you got?
Dorothy in Georgia says, now that we're in the new year, what papers do I have to save and what do I shred? Credit card bills, utility bills, etc.
So what I do is I save them all until I've gone through doing my taxes. And then it becomes a much easier process to figure out what you can get rid of. As an example, for charitable contributions today, it's very common that you do those on a credit card. So any credit card statement that involves a charitable contribution on that monthly statement, you want to keep that statement going forward and have it as supporting documentation with your copy of your tax return. Any bank statements that are no longer relevant, you don't need anymore. Anything involving insurance policies, if it's like your homeowners or auto or bills for anything like that, you don't need to keep those necessarily going forward. Trying to think of what other kinds of supporting documents and statements we get. The reality is, because so much of the bills we get now are available to refer back to online, the necessity of keeping the actual paper bills has become so much less important. And so I think that you start with the credit cards, anything that would be a recent statement, I'd say your last two or three statements, if there's nothing involved that will ever come into play with your tax return, you keep just those. And every time you get a new statement, you get rid of the prior one so that you just have the final, the last three. This is important if you're ever involved with the chargeback. You want to make sure you're not charged for something twice or anything like that. You lose the ability to track as well when you go to electronic statements for credit cards. I love paper statements for credit cards. And I'm sure there are some things I forgot that I should have mentioned about keeping and shredding or throwing out. But for now, that'll do. Joel?
Clark Grant in Arizona says, hey, Clark, you are a stud. Thank you so much for all of your help through the years. My question is about cruises. Is there a cruise newsletter out there like Scott's Cheap Flight, except for just cruise-based? I'm just trying to figure out how to get great deals on cruises now that the cruise lines are going to start cruising again shortly.
There are two in particular sources that I like for you to subscribe to that are free newsletters, because the idea in the cruise industry is people who book cabins want you to know about deals so that you'll book with them. You don't have to, but that's what they're hoping you do. And one of them is cruisecompete.com that has a pricing thing that you see prices from various people. Another, vacationstogo.com, has a cruise newsletter. And if you're riding around while you're listening to this podcast, you can see links to these on Clark.com on our travel section, and you'll find these particular newsletters that you can use looking to book a cruise.
Okay, Clark, another travel question for you. Bob in Florida says, this question's about travel and money. I use a Monster Bank because about once every 2 to 5 years, I will be traveling across the country and find a deal on an antique motorcycle, car, or airplane project. This culture always wants cash for out-of-state buyers. I carry enough cash for a down payment, but I have to go to a bank for the rest. If my money was in a Florida credit union and I needed $10,000 cash in California, how could I get it?
Wow, what an unusual situation. And I will tell you something about credit unions, that many credit unions are members of credit union cooperatives, where you can go to a credit union different than the one you're a member of. They validate your identity, and you can do transactions in a credit union branch far away from home as if you are in your home local credit union. And that way you can move away from the giant monster mega bank. And, you know, I don't like you with any of them. So with a local credit union, see if they're part of a credit union co-op that would allow you this privilege of going to credit unions far away from home. And you want to see a list to see how widespread the offices would be. Otherwise, I guess you could look at it as, for now, you're stuck as a prisoner of one of the four giant monster mega banks. Yuck.
All right, Clark. Lee in Wisconsin says, what would be the best real estate option for a young, single, penny pincher like myself? Should I go in the direction of house hacking a duplex, purchasing it, renting one side out, living on the other side, or something more like a shed to housing option, purchasing a constructed shed that I could rent out to other people?
So this is something Joel and I, as real estate investors, have both disagreed on politely for a long time. I believe that buying a home that has like a garage apartment or a basement apartment, or in your case, you were talking about a shed, anything that principally is a single family home with the possibility of a second dwelling unit on the property or already existing a second dwelling unit is preferable to a duplex. My reason for it is that often duplex properties are in neighborhoods with other duplexes, often with a very high ratio of rentals to owner-occupied properties. On the other hand, when you buy a property that has a second dwelling unit as part of it, but not a traditional duplex, you tend to be in a neighborhood that has a higher percent of owner-occupied. Why my obsession with owner-occupied? Owner-occupied neighborhoods tend to have a greater appreciation and value over time than neighborhoods that are very heavily absentee-owned with a heavy concentration of renters. I mean, both are great, but my preference is that you have a principal residence with a smaller ancillary rental as part of the piece of property. And coming straight ahead on today's podcast, I got more for you about not letting guilt ruin your finances. This edition of the Clark Howard Show podcast is Guilders Anonymous, where you guilt yourself into destroying your finances and quietly eat up your future. And how did you guilt yourself into doing that? You borrow out of guilt so that your child can go to his or her dream college or university. And this is not a great idea. So the U.S. Department of Education has something called the College Scorecard. And you can go on there when your son or daughter is starting to form thoughts about where he or she is going to go to college. And it will show you how much the typical borrowing is for a kid going to college there. But there's more. Because, see, the real dirty secret, particularly with private colleges and with for-profit colleges, is not how much the student borrows, because there are tight caps on what a student can borrow for college. It's how parents demolish their futures by borrowing massive amounts under what's known as Parent Plus. Parent Plus loans deal with your guilt that you didn't have the money for your kid to go to this, that, or the other private university, and does that at the cost of eating up your future. Do you know there's 1.7 trillion there, it's eventually real money. $1.7 trillion outstanding in student loans. That is ridiculous. And colleges have looked at parents as an endless source of funds that has eliminated any discipline on the part of colleges to control their expenses and in turn what it costs to go to that college. You know, when I went on tours with my middle child of colleges, they kept showing these fantabulous facilities on the campuses that were much like private clubs. And you're not sending your son or daughter off to school to go to a private club, I hope. You're sending them to school to get a skill, to get an education that enables them to earn a living for themselves and do some mind expansion if that's part of what you want. But the idea is to create income and job security. So I saw a New York Times item about where I went to undergraduate school, the American University in Washington, D.C. And it shows from data on that college scorecard I was telling you about at ed.gov, what somebody is likely to earn graduating with an undergraduate degree from American and versus what kind of money parents have borrowed for a kid to go to school there. Now, you've heard me say that you should never borrow more for a degree than what you're likely to earn the first year on a job. Well, at American, depending on which degree a kid gets, what their course of study is, they'll earn likely first year on a job $27,000 to max $74,000. But the parents, coupled with what the students borrow, are borrowing on average more than that. I mean, come on. This is bonkers. So I know you have a case of the guilts, but let me tell you something. What happens with your son or daughter's life is not going to be determined by whether they go to this school, that school, or the other school. It's going to be determined by what they do with the education they get at wherever they go. And yes, I went to American U for undergraduate school back when it costs like nothing to go to a private school. My tuition was $1,200 a semester. And I was able to pay my own way through. Grad school, I went to a directional college. I went to Central Michigan University. And when you hear somebody say directional, that's when it's like blah, 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 Northwestern State or South, North, East, West. And those schools, truth be told, educate a huge percent of college students in the United States, but don't have any cachet, or they're not looked at as, oh, wow, your son or daughter's going there. So what? I got a great education in my master's degree, and it led to so many great things in my life. And I graduated with zero debt. And that's a really good number. It's time for your questions you have for me at clark.com/ask. And Krista, looks like you're going to jump the gun and go before Joel here.
Okay. Well, Elizabeth in Georgia says, my son's car recently broke down and we're awaiting an estimate for repair. They may decide to total it, and I'm not sure which is the best option for him, to purchase or lease. He is 18 years old, working part-time and going to college online. His car is paid for, so whatever we get will be used for a down payment slash savings. I've never leased a car before due to the miles I drive for work, but thinking it may make sense for him since he won't be driving long distances as well as won't have the burden of vehicle maintenance.
Very interesting posing of a question about leasing versus buying, and I would give a very different kind of concept. The people who do best with a vehicle in terms of the finances that, what it costs to have that vehicle, are people who buy a vehicle that somebody else already leased, as an example. A vehicle that's got some age on it that you can buy at a very low price. The vehicle that was destroyed was a used car. Replacing it with one of a similar age should leave you even Steven with no ongoing payments and no ongoing obligation, particularly since not a lot of miles are going to be driven. Buying a used car of the equivalent era of the vehicle that may well be totaled out is the way that you best preserve your finances. Leases very rarely, if ever, make any sense. And generally, a lease only works for someone who looks at it as a lifestyle choice and gets new wheels every couple of years, or in the category of luxury vehicle buyers, somebody who is buying one from a brand that is subsidizing the lease. And the way you know It's what's known as a factory subsidized lease for a luxury vehicle. Is it's in their national ads of the brand, not a particular dealer. But in the case where you're just looking for good, affordable transportation, a used vehicle that you buy is best.
All right, Clark. Mike in Oregon says, "Hi, Team Clark. Thank you for the great service you provide to your listeners. It's greatly appreciated. My question pertains to freezing my credit. If I freeze my credit, does it create any problems when my current card issuers send renewal cards when the current ones expire? Secondly, does freezing my credit stop the unsolicited credit card offers I constantly keep receiving in the mail?"
So when you freeze your credit, it does nothing to your existing credit at all. So when you get a renewal card, you know, the one card expires, they send you the new one, you activate it, nothing changes with a credit freeze. The purpose of a credit freeze is to prevent anyone who has your personal information, and our personal information pretty much is out there, from being able to apply for credit as if they're you. What was the last part of that question, Joel, I missed?
So are they going to stop getting credit card solicitations,
solicitations
in the mail?
So credit card solicitations will continue typically even if your credit is frozen, but in smaller numbers than you get now. Those solicitations tend to come based on other mailing lists rather than those coming from the traditional credit bureaus, Equifax, TransUnion, or the major credit bureaus, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian. I've noticed that I went from receiving basically zero credit solicitations years ago, but now that credit freeze is so common, the banks have come up with other ways to come up with what they call qualified leads or lists. And so the number of solicitations coming to me has steadily increased again. And I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. If you just kind of found your way to us, you can subscribe. Just click and subscribe. And if you really love it, tell other people. If you hate it, tell many more. No, tell us at clark.com/ClarkStinks.